at me now, 17 months later, this is amazing, you know? And it does, you know? So hang in there. That's kind of the thing. Hang in there because it will get better.
Hang in, help's coming.
Yep, help's coming. Yeah, that's what you told me. Yeah. Yeah. Hang in there, help's coming. And then Southern accent.
Fix it.
Right, we're fixing to get you in here, right?
Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. This podcast is dedicated to mental wellness for first responders and beyond. Through powerful stories, personal experiences, and expert insights, we explore the challenges and triumphs of maintaining resilience in the face of adversity. Together, we remind you, no one fights alone.
Hey, welcome back to the No One Fights Alone podcast with Ben Pierce and Brad Shepherd and our guest today, Pat McMonagle. Hey, welcome guys to the actual No One Fights Alone podcast room at Chateau. We're all here together. Welcome, Pat.
Hey, it's good to be here. Nice room.
Isn't this awesome?
Yeah.
It's pretty rare. I normally am remote. I'm doing the podcast in Oklahoma, and Ben's up here sitting over there at the desk, and then whoever else is remote. And it's really awesome to have people in here because there's something really special about just being in the same room, same presence, and having conversations, you know, in each other's
presence. Yeah, thanks. So. No, I appreciate you having me, you know, real here. We do so much in the virtual world that is tough always, you know. So,
it really is.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
So how is your, before I do a official,
yeah,
you know, bio intro here, you've been walking around here a few hours and
yeah, it's weird. It's weird to come back. It's awesome. It's a little weird. Coming to the grounds yesterday. First of all, it's beautiful outside right now. It's gorgeous. Amazing. So that is a really great time to come. And I was here in the fall. So I was here about 16 months ago, I guess, or 17 months ago when I first showed up. So it would have been fall. It was really pretty, you know, crisp there. But I'm out of the Seattle area. So it's, you know, we haven't seen the sun since September, so it's really nice to see what the sun looks like. And it's just beautiful, for one, but it's also weird and triggering, but also awesome, too, and great and uplifting, you know, to be back here and be good now. You know,
it's a special place.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys do a special thing here. Yeah.
Special place when you've been through the program and you've been through, you know, the journey of Chateau. It's not just a place. It's a journey.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I came back.
Yeah, pretty weird, huh? Yeah.
Heavy.
Yeah, heavy.
Right? That there's a lot of emotions you can stick with, you know, coming back to Chateau.
We were talking about it too, just the smells. And not that it smells bad. I mean, it smells pretty good. It's clean, you know. But the smells of the main room and, you know, like the, you know, the just the noises and stuff people are making. So I really appreciate, you know, being with the group. And, it was cool. It's it just shows where I've come from, and I really just appreciate that. So it's cool.
Love it.
Yeah.
For our listeners, let me do an official introduction to Pat McMonagle, FBI, former FBI analyst and special agent.
Yeah.
Now raising kids, living your best life in retirement.
Yeah.
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 Welcome to the podcast, man. I'm so thankful that you're taking time out of your day to your life, actually your family life.
You got
a lot of stuff going on at home, but you took time out to come because you have a great message.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's just cool to be here, and it's cool to have an opportunity to push that message out, right? And hopefully help other people, right? I mean, that's what it's all about.
Well, I think for the listeners, I'll say this centers around a most recent article or publication, maybe is a better word, of something you wrote about your life, and in hopes we'll in no small part talk about that today, but the article that you wrote details out a lot of your story as much as you can in 4,600 words, right?
Yeah.
And really, the message behind it, the content, the spirit of it is really special. Well done.
Yeah, thank you very much. I got to hand it to them. I think they did a really great job with it.
Yeah.
You know, it took a little praying and thinking about it. Do I really want to, you know, go full Monty with everybody in the United States and the world and stuff with my whole story? But I thought, what the heck, you know, it's not going to help anybody but me if I just keep it by myself. And so I was really happy with how it came out. I think the tone, I was really concerned about hitting that right tone. Everything is so politicized right now and can just be seen as, you know, well, he's trying to do this or that, the other thing. And I just didn't detect any of that stuff. So I was really happy with how it came out. In 4,600 words, I mean, there's a couple things, and I can tell you about that, but like always, right? But it was cool. It was really neat. I'm glad I did it.
Can you tell us a little bit about where I like your point about, you know, it's not going to help anybody unless I actually get it out there.
Yeah, yeah.
How did the whole idea start? Because I think there's a lot of folks that in this journey of do I ask for help ever?
Yeah.
The answer is a strong no. Yeah. To my grave, the usual thing. We'll talk more about your journey of you taking a couple of steps that brought you into this situation. Yeah. But yeah, the idea of...
Well, I mean, I kind of went from, man, I don't want anybody to know I'm screwed up, right? To, I want the whole world to know because that's the way you're going to help others people. And that's, you know, I went to a conference one time or something like that, and it was about mental health or something. And it took everybody sitting back and kind of wondering, how are we going to talk about this? Until the toughest looking dude stood up and said, hey, I got problems or whatever. And I'm not saying I'm the toughest looking dude, but, you know, and then that gives confidence and courage to other people to say, yeah, I got things I want to change and fix. And I struggle too with stuff, and this is a normal thing. So,
but you don't know who really looks up to you though, right? Who in the room finds you the toughest dude? I've found that fascinating.
I think that's true.
I remember the first time toughest guy in the room stood up and said something, and then later, you know, you were viewed that way.
Yeah.
Or other people looked up to you, and now you've become,
you never know, you know, right? Yeah.
You just never know who's listening or who's paying attention or who says, man, I'm sure glad you did that.
And, you know, honestly, and I kept, because the girls who wrote the article, I wrote it, but then they ghost wrote it. they said, hey, this is really good. We never thought an FBI agent could write this well, but we're still going to rewrite it about six more times. Okay. So I worked with them, but.
Hey, you did an okay job.
They did fine. We found some misspellings. I'm not surprised, but I really wanted, hey, if it could help one guy, one gal too, right, then it's worth it, right? Yeah. If I could have heard somebody like myself talk to me when I was really down and out, that would be worth the embarrassment or whatever I've got. You know, that's small, right? So I think that's kind of in a nutshell.
If you look at this from, you hinted at it a while ago, but if you look at this from, I'm curious to know what are some things that gave you pause, like judgment.
Yeah.
Am I going to hurt? Am I going to damage? Am I going to, you know, things that we now know is probably culturally, misinformation
or
cultural standards that are not accurate of, if I talk, how am I going to be viewed? Any of that run through your mind?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is judgment piece, right? Yeah. And the biggest thing is you're worried, you know, when you're vulnerable with people, you're worried about, wow, what are they going to think about you? Are they going to think you're weak? Are they going to think, and I am, we all are weak, right? Yeah. Like, you know, I can get past that, right? And then I was worried about, one, I was worried about my mom because she didn't know the whole story, right? I didn't want to I didn't want to traumatize her even more. I mean, she really helped me through a lot, but, and then I was worried about my dad reading it and, you know, all these little things you've got, right? So it's mostly judgment. But once I put it out, you know, it was, I waited a little bit, nothing happened. And then all of a sudden this world of, this positive energy world came back to me. I literally, you know, we don't really turn off our phones much anymore because they're always on, but I literally turned my phone off because I had all this incoming positive messages about it. Like, hey, that's such a cool story. Thanks for sharing it. This is actually kind of cool. When I was working on the article, I had it on my computer and my son borrowed my computer to do his homework or whatever it was. And I hadn't done a good job of, you know, hiding my computer activities. And so he read it, but I didn't know this. And later, he's 13. And later, he says, "Hey, Dad, can I talk to you about something?" And I said, "Yeah, sure. Is everything okay?" He's like, "Oh yeah, it's okay." You know, but I could tell something was going on. I was like, "Oh no, whatever." I got four kids, so it's always something going on. And he starts crying. And he says, "Hey, Dad, I really, really love you. I just want you to know, and thank you for what you did for me and the family and stuff." And that was just
wow.
And I said, "Well, one, I'm kind of mad at you." Well, first said, "Don't get mad at me," you know. And I was like, "Oh, what'd you do?" And he's like, "I read your article." And I was like, "I didn't really want you to read that, right? You know, because I just thought it was kind of adult content, right?" But for him to be able to say that, and you know, because ultimately that's why I did so much thing, the things I did, and then ultimately why I left was for my family and for him and stuff. So that was cool. Yeah,
but that's a great moment.
Yeah.
So he was saying, "Just so you're clear, Dad, I love you. You're okay. You're doing okay as a dad."
He's trying to take care of you a little bit. Because a lot of times you think maybe I screwed this part up as a dad. So that was nice to hear. But
right.
He also said there's a part in the article when I just really unravel. And that's when the next day I called you, Brad. And but it was at his football practice. And he says, "Now I get what happened, why, you know, Joe's dad drove you home," or whatever. And I don't even remember getting home.
Yeah.
But you know, the kids were oblivious to all this stuff that happened.
Yeah.
Well,
not completely.
And they see that mommy and daddy is you know, a little bit off, right? Yeah. And it affects them a lot, but they don't know exactly what's happening.
Sure.
So yeah, it's the judgment, right?
Right.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
That's great. But, that's a great story of your son. Probably not how you would have envisioned that being unpacked.
Yeah.
But the reality is it was received.
I would have waited until he was a lot older, right? Yeah.
Yeah. To let a lot of love, a lot of kindness, a lot of grace.
But
understanding.
Yeah. Relationships with your children is really important. And we all have issues and things that go through. So this whole story, one of the positive outlets of this is really just appreciating my kids more now, to be honest. And trying to love them a little more and stuff. And I don't think we could ever do enough of that, right?
Yeah. Nope, for sure. Well, before we get into the article, which the article talks a little bit about some of your backstory, but you know, just for the listeners, I think the article, if I remember right, kind of starts college era.
Yeah.
But kind of growing up, a little bit of backstory there, kind of fill us in a little bit on that.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Spokane, Washington. My dad was a military guy. He's a true hero when you think of these kind of heroes. We don't really have too many of them around. He did two tours in Vietnam. I mean, these stats are, anybody knows, these stats are like crazy. People will be like, "You really making that up?" He has 5 bronze stars, 2 silver stars, and a Purple Heart. So he was I mean, just, you know, tough guy. But also a very loving dad, right? And so I grew up with him, and my mom was a teacher. Grew up in Spokane, Washington. Really beautiful area of the country. My 2 older sisters are a lot older, so I was almost like an only child, but had a great best friend who was like a brother to me. Really good childhood. Really good place to live. And then I went to school in California, in college in California, and left junior year of college. I had a college classmate, Dura Bodley, her name is, she died in 9/11. So she was a friend of mine. You know, we weren't really close, but we're close enough that I'd see her at parties, and I knew she had a great voice, and she was into theater and stuff. Mm-hmm. She was on flight 93, so we all remember what happened in 93. She was the youngest person to be on the plane. She wasn't supposed to be on the plane. And she was so excited to get back to school in California because it was later in the year, right? So we were on the quarter system. So she got on an earlier flight, and they're like, "Yeah, we got room on this plane." So anyway, that I think we all probably remember where we were on 9/11. I remember exactly where I was. And then we found out a couple of days later that we had a classmate on there, and it was Diora. So, you know, I knew I wanted to serve somehow, be in the Army, be in the military or something like that, like my dad. But then I changed my major and decided I wanted to be in the FBI or the CIA or something cool, where I'd fight terrorists, you know? So that kind of framed my, I think, my motivation. And then in college, I decided to study Arabic and, you know, go to grad school and do some things and really make myself set up well to, you know, to join an organization like that. So I joined the FBI in 2005. And at that point, they had 80,000 applicants for 1,000 positions. So, I mean, it was really tough. I originally came in as an analyst under a government program, and then I went to the academy a couple years later, and I remember thinking, I'm not in the right group. Some of these guys are, you know, like, we had some former Navy SEALs, we had like a doctor in a class, we had people who had been in Wall Street who left million-dollar careers and things like that. So you have some really cool people, and you're kind of looking around the room like, I shouldn't be here. So as an FBI agent, before that, I actually worked for Defense Department for a little while, and did a lot of HUMIT training. So kind of my love was always working with people and source operations and things like that. So I did that a lot with the FBI and counterterrorism. And then with the FBI, I went overseas to Afghanistan and Somalia, and worked with the military and agencies overseas and stuff. Had a pretty exciting career doing a lot of exciting stuff, mostly counterterrorism type deal. And I was in Sacramento Division, California, where we had some like legit terrorism cases and some, you know, fun times looking back, like some pretty high stress kind of things. And then we got to move back to Washington State, where I'm from. And then I worked there, domestic terrorism, international terrorism. I took a desk. I was a supervisor for a human intelligence running sources, kind of a specialized squad. And then I was on the board of the FBI Agents Association for 6 years. So that's like our union where we represented the agents, really did a lot with people. So we had like a couple funds. One of the funds was set up to take care of fallen agents, families, and, you know, people who died in line of duty, people who didn't die, you know, just, you know, in a car wreck or whatever. So I got a lot of experience seeing the whole agency.
Was this state specific, that association? Was that a state specific?
No, it was for the whole the
entire bureau. Organization.
The entire organization. So I had everybody.
A separate entity.
Yes, this is like our union kind of thing.
Okay,
So there's 14,000 agents. Yeah. Well, there's a little less, but we represented almost 90% of them. And just got a lot of experience with the bureau that way. Oh, geez, I'm drying out. But anyway, that's kind of my background, yeah.
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 So just for the listeners, HUMIT is specifically...
Human intelligence. That's running sources, informants.
Right.
And, you know, the Bureau does run sources for everything from, you know, drug buys to counterintelligence operations sources into Russia or China or whatever the heck it is. So
so you have a side...
Specialized, right? Yeah.
Just again, I'm curious on some of your background. So how many... Do you speak multiple languages?
No, I barely even speak English on that, most of it. No, I mean, just Spanish and other things. But like a lot of times overseas, you have interpreters who help you with
of course.
That kind of stuff as well. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so... We're now part of an association, and I'm assuming part of that is dealing with and seeing other agents out here having hurdles and having hardships within their life, if not up to and including death or even losing agents, I'm sure was a part of that. Is that a pretty difficult tasking with that association? People's lives are just messy. You know,
Lives are messy, and then when you have an organization that's so big, you know, somebody's always having problems, right?
Yeah.
And so being on the board, I represented everybody in the West. And so there was about 3,300 agents in the West. But everybody had different places. But you'd get requests for assistance, and they would come up by email. And you'd hear, you know, an agent in Chicago's daughter is, you know, having cancer or whatever. And so then you'd kind of find out about their life and then assist them, you know, any way you can with money or however it is.
Sure.
So you get a really good sense of kind of all the people problems, right?
Sure.
You know? Yeah. And then you hear about all the deaths, and there were, you know, with 14,000 agents, there's a lot of deaths every year, right? Some line of duty, couple line of duty, right? Things are pretty, the risk is pretty well mitigated, but then also some suicides and things as well. So, yeah.
Within that real quick. So as you walk through kind of your career, curious what home life is like during the,
yeah.
I know we might be getting to that in a different way, but I'm curious as you're seeing it, responding to it, there's an at work part.
Yeah.
You're managing resources.
You're doing, right?
That sort of stuff. But I'm curious how you talked about someone else's struggle when you're at home with the wife and kids.
You know, I think, my wife used to always say, you're so good at just compartmentalizing this, just turning this off when you walk in the door and, you know, you pick up the kids, you're happy to see the kids and stuff. And you try and leave that stuff as much as you can. I think it's some ways easier when you deploy or go overseas because you literally leave it there, right? Mm, yeah. But then, you get a phone call. But then,
sorry,
it's okay. But then also times, you know, as an agent, you're kind of a program manager of your investigation. So you may have your surveillance team out or your sources out in operations, and this is on weekends, and they may be calling you or whatever. So you're really never off totally. So you have to kind of manage these two worlds, right? And be at your kid's soccer game or whatever,
sure.
or coach or whatever the heck it is, right? And so you've got to kind of stay in both worlds, and it's tough.
But you're still carrying two or three phones around.
Yeah, I was carrying two, right? Which is a nice thing. Now I only carry one, right?
Yeah.
I was carrying two stupid phones around, and and dealing with that. Home life's great. I always have had a really supportive wife. My wife and I were college sweethearts, and she knew that I always wanted to do something, service wise. So she always supported me. Got a little harder when you have kids, you know, because now you got more going on. It's just a struggle, right? Doesn't everybody have it, right? Or you think everybody's got the same kind of stuff, yeah? Yeah.
That's the common denominator, really, in this first responder culture is that you're really taught and trained and encouraged that compartmentalization.
Yeah.
Of, leave work at work and home stays at home and try not to mix the two.
Yeah.
Doesn't always work.
No, it doesn't always work. Yeah.
Well, even like what you said, you know, for your wife, just like she giving you a compliment.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, yeah, I'm duct tape and hose clamps, just keeping this together.
Just keeping this running, right?
I'm glad you think it looks great.
I do remember, this is almost kind of funny, like one of our first Thanksgivings, and we just had one baby. Don't ask me who, because I got four of them, but we had one baby, right? And so we had all these people over for Thanksgiving, and they were coming to the house, and she's putting all this stuff together, and it's like the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. I'm like, honey, I'm really sorry, but they want to send me to Canada. And she's like, well, when? You're going to be back for Thanksgiving, right? I'm like, no, Canada, I was in California, kind of a long ways away, and I'm going to miss Thanksgiving. And she handled it really well, but I was gone to interview some goofball up there and do this crazy case and stuff. And she's at home with a new baby, and my parents and all, you know, my partner was even at our house and stuff like that. And you just do what you got to do, right? But
duty calls.
That's one thing she'll bring back up again, you know.
Remember when?
Yeah, remember when, right? Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're doing work at the association, and if we kind of keep progressing through your article, if we stay online with that, where do we go next?
Well, so I was a supervisor for a while, and not that great to be a supervisor. The management sucks, or management would be great if it weren't for the people, right? But so I did that for a little while, and then I stepped down because I wanted to do casework again, and I came back to doing casework. And I picked up a case. Then I was doing domestic terrorism. So I picked up a case involving a little boy. I'll call Bo because I called him that in the article. And it was just a really terrible case. And before, you and I maybe talked about this before, I'd done clean counterterrorism stuff, right? And even been overseas, and, you see stuff, crazy stuff. But this one really hit me hard because this little boy was 13 years old, and this group overseas, had kind of lured him online, found him online. He was already having some mental health struggles, got him to kill himself. And it was tough, not only tough just because of that, but it was also occurred in my hometown right behind the grocery store where we shopped at. So there was just a lot of similarities and stuff. And then investigating this, the local police department was, you know, needing more resources and stuff because the perpetrators were overseas. And so we got involved. And we got to know the parents a little bit because we kept giving them updates and stuff. Good people. You know, the dad was a military vet. Mom was a teacher. Just, you know, just regular family, right? And this poor kid. And so this just started to really, really affect me. And I just couldn't compartmentalize. I couldn't put it back in that box very much, especially because I had kids too, you know. And it opened up this world of, what do they call it? CSAM, child sexual abuse material. And just this, just floodgates of just crap, you know, that's out there that people are doing to children and stuff. And it was just too much.
Do you think there was any, impact or do you think there was a correlation between how the proximity, like it was a neighboring town? It was right here.
It was in my town. Yeah.
Like what was the impact of that? Like you're seeing this happen. Most of the work you've done to your point is overseas or this big picture stuff, or, you know, you're doing tip of the spear, front end work.
Yeah. I think that's a good point.
Now it's like, holy shit. This is,
it can happen like anywhere. I mean, that's the thing. If it's happening in my hometown, it can happen anywhere, and it is happening everywhere. Yeah. And then it's the kind of the gravity of evil of the world. This is what's happening out there.
Right.
And yeah, I think that was a big factor in it.
Well, we get in that spot quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's always someone else.
Right. Yeah.
They're different. Yeah. Not quite the same. Then it's like, it might be my state. It's my city.
Right. Look at these poor guys.
My house isn't that different.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I'm not that different. Yeah. Especially when you're poking around evil for as long as you poked around evil. Yeah. Like, there's some parts of me that aren't so great, and this person's been humanized a little bit, and that's not too different than how I got one of those parts too.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's
I think that's absolutely,
it's wild how that stuff works. And that's ironically, I think that's part of how some of our triggers are built.
Yeah.
Is it it's nice and convenient and compartmentalized when it's just someone else, and all of a sudden
it's not anymore, right?
Not anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're kind of thinking, geez, when is it going to be my kids, or when am I next, right? Or, you know.
Well, it's a when, right? Yeah. In your line of work.
Yeah, geez. So, it got to be too much. And then, I mean, I talked about it a little bit in the article. I didn't know that I was struggling. I didn't know I had PTSD. Like my dad's time, there was no word for that or whatever. Sure. And so I just thought, oh, man, I didn't know it had anything to do with this case or anything. Yeah. That was going on or any, you know, anything like that. My wife is a therapist. She was trying to help me out as much as possible. And then she said, hey, you need to go see this lady. She'd help me out and I went to see this nurse psychologist. She could prescribe medications and stuff. And I'm telling her what's going on and explaining this stuff. Like AMD, she's a lot better looking than you guys were, though. But
clearly,
I'm just kind of going through
it.
She's like, yeah, I'm just going through it. And she says, you have PTSD. And I said, I know you've been doing this a long time, but that's for tough guys like Navy SEALs, Green Berets, and stuff. I don't think so.
Yeah.
And she was like a Navy doc or whatever, worked in some like in a prison or something terrible, right? She's like, no, Pat, come on. Let me repeat back to you what you just told me. And then it kind of dawned on me like, man, maybe I did get a little messed up from all this stuff. So that kind of began the recovery period, right?
Now, at this point, how many years had you had in the agency? Let's just, for the listeners, frame that up.
I had probably been 14, 15 years as an agent. I had 5 years previous to that as an analyst and then the DOD and stuff. So I kind of include all that time.
So you've been walking in the quagmire of evil for a hot minute.
And the other thing is too, Brad, you've seen it in your line of work. Not a lot of people stay in that like operational ranks for very long, right?
And stay healthy.
And stay healthy. Right. Yeah. So I'd been in that operational rank. Like I, you know, I'd been a supervisor for a little while, but never been to headquarters and sat some, been a program manager or whatever. Yeah. And, but you know,
So she says, no, seriously. And you're like, that's a good one.
I know you're kidding. What's really going on?
And but then, how did that, it may not have been that day. For a lot of times, it's not that day. When did that really turn into, she might have a point?
Well, I thought she had, might have a point. I was struggling. I was struggling in the mornings. I was struggling. I had this thing where I would just feel really, really cold in the mornings when I wake up. And you know, and if I laid there, I could work myself up into this panic attack. And I mean, it was totally debilitating, right? And I became a guy. I mean, I was trying to hide this from my squad, all the guys, right? Sure. I was trying to hide it from my family. Yeah. I was trying to, but you can't really, you know, and like, what is wrong with you, you know? And then I just, and then I started developing this tick in my arm and I just was getting all messed up. And so we cycled through meds. I found a therapist who was a former detective. So I went through some really good therapists too. And she spoke the right language and she understood because she had worked this crazy bad stuff too. And she had worked the kids stuff. I think the kids stuff is particularly bad and difficult.
Do you have a view now that probably better than what it was then, but do you have a view now on some of the things that you were exhibiting, maybe behaviors or thoughts or actions that should have been red flags and you just kind of ignored them and said, you know, if you're shaking your head, can you detail out some of those? Like, man, I should have known from this or.
Yeah.
Clearly you're not listening to your wife.
But no, next. I must be the only guy that has that problem, right?
He only lived that down the rest of his days.
Yeah,
right. I've been telling you for a while. Now some stranger walks
what
in.
Did you say?
Well,
I mean, you know, the funny part of it is that is kind of exactly, you're tuning things out, right?
Yeah.
And it's almost like you have this computer program in the back of your mind that's just running.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of going through the wickets, right? But yeah, I was pulling away from a lot of things, right?
Yeah.
I'm a pretty social guy, and I didn't really want to hang out much anymore. You know, I didn't want to do much except hang out with my dog, and being around the kids was just hard. I was far more irritable.
It was funny when you specifically to that.
Yeah,
and if I can pause in that.
Yeah,
it's funny you don't realize that for what it is.
Yeah,
like when you're pulling back, you just think I need this.
Yeah,
but you know the official version of that or language of that is social isolation. Mm. And you're like, I just don't want to do people.
I don't,
at all, you know?
Or even like you just said, things that are normally feeling pretty good, like hanging out with the kids and enjoying all that stuff. Like they're just not fun anymore.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, I got to a point where I just want to be in bed. Right.
Right.
I don't want to go to the gym anymore. Yeah. And the more you stay in bed, the worse you feel too.
Yeah. Eating, sleeping, what'd that look like?
Well, right before Chateau, I wasn't eating very much at all. So I was pretty, bad shape. Now I like to eat. Chateau made me really eat well. But it was, you know, it's like, you taste food again, right? Yeah. Like you eat, you don't want to eat. It's as though you're taking you're trying to, I don't know. You're just not really taking care of yourself in any way.
Yeah.
I wear the same shirt. I'd sleep in the same shirt.
Yeah.
You're just doing whatever. It's almost like you're falling and you're letting go of things that make you heavier, right? But you just can't let go at all. Mm. I just was in a tailspin, right? Worse and worse. And even after that initial diagnosis, right? I'm trying all these different meds, nothing's working. Go to the ER because I think I'm having a heart attack or whatever. And they're like, no, you're just having a panic attack. Just go home. And like, I mean, panic attacks are the worst, right? They're just terrible, right? All just so messed up.
On top of having to explain it.
Yeah.
They're obviously like.
And you're hiding it. You're trying to hide it.
Nothing going on here.
It's a combination of hiding it. And I hear a lot of folks talk about the need to exaggerate it because it's not being taken seriously.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah.
And there's no win.
Yeah.
nothing
nervous,
to do.
I'm nervous all the time, and like right. I was just no good. I just felt like I was just no good. Yeah.
Which leads us up to, you know, that moment, kind of getting us back on track here a little bit.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Of it's all coming together to culminate into a pretty bad day.
Pretty bad day. So, there was one fall day, right? I was like, I'm feeling pretty good. And, you know, I'll take Jack, my oldest son, to football practice, right? And so I drop him off for football practice, and I'm thinking, oh, this is pretty, I'll sit here on the bleachers and I'll check my email, right? My work email, right? And I open up an email from Bo's mom, and this had been, I don't remember, 9 months into the investigation or so. Bo had just had a birthday, and so she sent me an email, my partner too, and saying, hey, you know, basically like, we really appreciate you guys, what you've done. You know, you're taking this seriously, and just saying some touching stuff. And so she had included pictures of Bo, just being a kid, some childhood pictures of him. And previously I had seen Bo, in this, you know, suicide video and things like that, you know, like, so I knew him as different. And so I'm reading this and I'm sitting on the bleachers and I am just overcome with emotion, right? And I can't put that in the box, right? I'm sitting there and the kids are practicing out in front of me. People are you know, there's people walking around the track and stuff. And I'm so embarrassed because I cannot stop crying. A buddy, kind of a buddy, he was my son's dad's friend, comes over to me. I don't know him that well. And he's like, hey, what's going on? And I'm just blabbering stuff. And he can tell something's wrong with me. You know, he knew I was FBI agent, I, you know, whatever. And so he got me home and my wife put me to bed. And, I kind of don't even remember getting home or anything like that. And, made an appointment with my therapist, the next day, kind of emergency appointment. And they're both like, man, we can't fix you anymore. We need to send you someplace like Chateau. And that's when I called you. Thank God you answered. Yeah. And I mean, I remember like it was yesterday. I remember I was in my bed and, you know, in your Southern accent, you said, hey, man, I got you. I've been there. I understand how I know this. You know, I don't remember exactly what you said, but it was just that feeling, right? I got you. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to bring you in. And I knew I was okay. You know, I mean, the hard part was waiting to get in here. There was a little bit of a wait. And then just organizing that. And it was hard to say goodbye to the family and kind of make an excuse. Daddy's got to go away for a little while and stuff like that. And it was hard to get on that airplane to leave. My partner drove me to the airport, put me on, you know. I remember leaving that morning and my other son, Patrick, out of the window is like, bye, Dad, you know, and I'm like, this is tough, but I got to go get better and get better for these guys, right? Yeah.
It's interesting you say that.
You're good.
It's interesting you say that because your family was already used to you leaving. But yeah, this one was significantly different.
I had left a lot. I just travel once in a while. I mean, literally, though, there's a little, I mean, I'm not telling the story because it's a little longer than that, but like, I'm like to my wife, honey, I'd rather go back to Afghanistan or something. At least that would be fun, right? I don't want to go to some.
I know what to expect, at least.
Yeah. Some, you know, check myself into some psych ward or something like that. You don't know what you're expecting, right?
No, I help a lot of, deal mostly with first responders, veterans coming in, but across the board.
Yeah.
And I remember experiencing this the same is. You're up to the task for a multitude of things. Put me in the game.
Yeah.
No fear. I will go to the dredges of hell and fight the battle. But this was a different battle.
This is a different one.
And you knew going into it, just like I did, this is going to be a really dark path.
It's going to be tough.
And it's all inward.
Yeah.
And I know what's coming.
Yeah.
It's pretty ugly.
Yeah. I was curious about that weight in those hours of, maybe you've already been through this, but a lot of folks are trying to cook up any excuse they can think of to not get on that plane. And
I cooked up some, right? I had a couple of,
fuck that guy from Oklahoma. And he don't know me.
I tried, but I also knew, like, man, I'm at the bottom of the barrel, right? I needed something, yeah. Right? And there was a time I was like, hey, good news is, honey, and the kids, I got them. I'm not leaving. Don't worry, it's not. I don't need to go anywhere. You know?
Yeah, of course.
And then yeah. I don't know whatever happened. Then the next day, a panic attack and blah blah blah. Yeah. And I'm like, maybe I do, right? So
yeah.
Good news. I watched the TED Talk. I'm fixed. Yeah, I'm great.
I fixed myself. I'm right? great. Yeah.
Now, what was your wife's thoughts and words during this time?
Well, it's kind of funny. I mean, she said, Pat, and my therapist said the same thing. Hey, we've done all we can do. I don't think we can fix you anymore from here, right? And it was pretty apparent to me. Like, I mean, I've been doing therapy once a week. I've been doing EMDR, which is it's not the music, not EMD. It's a rapid eye movement thing. Yeah, yeah, I've been doing a lot of stuff. Yeah. It just, I really needed a real intervention and to be at a place, right? We kind of figured out how we'll make this go. I went to my boss. I had a great boss, by the way, former Marine. She just took care of her people. She knew that I was struggling, having a hard time. We figured out my leave schedule to get me going. My sister came out to help out a little bit with the kids, you know, because that was going to be a hard thing. We just cleared the schedule to make it happen, and then worked with insurance and stuff. And yeah, do what you got to do, right?
Right, for sure. Yeah. So what's the you get off the plane and you show up? I'm not.
Yeah.
Totally curious about the. The chateau side of it, but yeah, I'm curious in your mind as you're like, you know, most people just have movie references and you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah,
stuff like
you
that.
I didn't know what to expect, right? Yeah.
But I think there's also this element of guys especially that spend their lives saying, There's no way I'm gonna take off this armor. There's no way I'm gonna let people in, and I'm gonna do whatever I have to, and what is the bare minimum of what I have to do.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of kind of small decisions that people never know.
Literally die with the armor on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not? Right.
Yeah. Why not? Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So I'm just, if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about some of those smaller decisions.
I think that's
made.
A really good concept for law enforcement, first responder. I mean, your armor is going to protect you, right? You don't take that off.
It's
right?
great
you
at
don't?
What it does. Yeah.
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 So, the guy that picked me up from the airport, I was telling you this last night, right? We were driving up through the mountains and stuff, and it's really pretty because it's October and the colors are changing, and it's here. There's a lot of mountains and stuff, and we're just chit-chatting. He says, boy, you picked a really good time to come here. And I'm like, I didn't really pick it.
It picked me.
Yeah, picked me, exactly. And you drag your sorry ass in here, and I did, you know. And it was a lot like, I don't know, the FBI Academy or government training or whatever. You're like, I'm going to get through this if it kills me kind of thing, right? Because, man, I almost lost my life anyway, right? So whatever it takes, right? And whatever goofy stuff they got for me, right, I'm going to do it all and do it all to the max, right? And because I'm not going to be there again. I'm not going to be at that bottom of the hole again, right? Yeah. So, but then when I know you're curious about the chateau part, but then you come in, you sit there, and just all of a sudden you start feeling this love from the house, right? Mm. You just know you're in the right place. I didn't really fight it. I know some guys did.
I did.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't chateau. Yeah. I was fighting.
Yeah.
I was fighting myself.
Yeah, you were.
Yeah.
And there's that part of it too, right? Yeah.
But I do think, you know, for those listening to this portion of it, you know, Chateau is not the only facility, but Chateau does an excellent job of receiving you and loving you and providing grace all throughout your stay. But initially, when you walk in the door, you're ready for battle. I know I was. I don't know what the fuck's coming, but I'm ready. And it's not that at all. It's this, we're glad you're here.
Yeah.
Was it similar?
It was. And you know, because I had about 2 weeks to prepare for it or whatever. So I'm looking up the website. I got to prep for this operation.
Yeah, yeah.
Like exactly. You're just doing all the research you can. And then you show up here and I think there, you know, it was a little bit after lunch and somebody comes over, hey, we'd let make you a plate of food and, you know, all this nice stuff. And you're thinking, oh, this isn't bad at all. And so then the nurses check you out. And I remember the nurse was kind of joking with me. She says, do you smoke? And I said, no. And she says, well, how come? You know, and I'm kind of laughing, you know, and I'm like, maybe this isn't going to be so bad, you know. And people start messing with you. And I thought that was good, actually. I was like, okay, we're all here for the same reason. And then you realize, hey, man, there's all kinds of people just like me here. And everybody came. And then as you stay longer time, you see other people come in that same way, right? You come in alone, but I think you leave. I mean, that sounds goofy, but you leave, you know, in numbers, right? I just know I'm with all these other brothers and sisters that have done this. So, yeah.
I know we got to talk a little bit, and I had you kind of set in on a session with me this morning.
That was really cool. And yeah.
Was it?
Did you enjoy that? I really liked that. Yeah. Thanks for doing that.
I thought it was awesome. And it was good for them, too.
Good group. Yeah. Well, I hope so. Yeah.
No, it really was. But that, do you remember that 4-part question? Like what you thought
yeah,
you lost?
Part A, B, yeah, C yeah, and stuff. Yeah, you lost me.
Too lengthy of a question. Yeah. But, you know, one of the things that if we kind of transit, which I don't want to leave to Chateau, the space, but, you know, something pretty awesome happened to you while you were in that space.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Can you kind of put words to that?
Yeah. So, you know, looking back on the time, it was a lot of fun, but it was a lot of work. I do remember one thing. I didn't describe it in the article too much because, there's only 4,600 words and I didn't want the message to be, taken in a weird way or whatever, but I had a really religious experience here, and this is a very secular place, and nothing, you know. My mom was worried I was going to become a Mormon because I was going to Utah. Don't worry, Mom. But, you know.
I did get a tattoo, but.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of pretty girls down here, actually. Yeah. It was one of those times where I'm laying on the ground doing grandfather's breaths with breathing exercise and with Native American stuff. And I thought at first, like, oh, this is so stupid. Like, there's smoke and this guy's banging on drums, dancing around. This is just goofy, you know. And so you're kind of fighting it, right? But then I thought, Pat, just go with it, you know. Like everything, you know, what the heck, you know. So I started saying some of my prayers and stuff just going with it and doing the breathing exercises. And I had this really cool religious experience where I first went around and tried to eradicate all the bad. So I'd heard all these trauma stories from all the people who had been here. Really, really tough stuff. Way worse than mine, right? So I would go find the dad that abused his daughter or whatever, beat him up or throw him in jail or whatever the heck it was. I had this stuff. And then I kind of wore myself out doing all this. all this. I'm a Catholic, so I'm pretty religious, faithful, hopefully that way. And so then Mother Mary came to me, kind of held me and said, hey, you don't need to do this, right? You know, you don't need to do this for me. Get all these bad guys, right? This is what we do, right? And then I was just holding all this. I got to take care of all these kids that are being victimized around the world. And she spoke to me saying, hey, this isn't really your thing. This is what I do, you know. I'll use you or whatever, you know. This was this kind of the message I was getting, right? And it was a cool experience. And then, you know, when we kind of woke up from it, we had an opportunity to share that and stuff. And I was like, whoa, man, I just went somewhere crazy, you know. But it was just a neat way to release, right? That continued on, a lot of that release. But, it was just cool to walk back in that room and where that happened, right?
That's really cool.
And last night they were doing that.
Yeah.
and hopefully it had some, you know, amazing experiences for the people who were doing it last night, too.
It was fun to watch you walk into that room today.
Yeah, a little weird. Yeah, you knew it was going to be weird.
I just remember the first time I came back
yeah.
and how Well, it's just a multitude of emotions that come with that.
It does.
You know, yeah. A lot of gratitude.
Yeah, mostly. A lot of gratitude.
But, you know, revisiting a lot of the pain and the hurt and the sadness and the loss.
Yep.
Of, you know,
the, there's a the lot path of, that's you let go in that room. Yeah.
So much that's let go. And I had a similar spiritual experience with Wim Hof during the breathing portion.
Yep.
I had a very
wild
spiritual out-of-body experience that happened. There's just, I think some of that's credited with slowing down and being intentional, allowing some of these, you know, these modalities that have worked for decades, if not centuries. And we're just too fast-paced to slow down enough to let them work on us.
Well, as you reference history, there's this reality that there's plenty of warriors over the course of history who were deeply spiritual, connected to their purpose.
Yes. Yep.
So it's not a coincidence at all that there's a piece of that.
Yeah.
You know, you want, you have all these skills and training, and there's, you know, literally a message of you don't need to go to work. Actually, let go of work, and there's a whole other things you can put your skills and talents and, you know, stuff towards.
So your experience then, kind of kicking us back off, your experience, one of them being, you know, the breathing, the spiritual experience you had.
Yeah.
Was that early in your time at Chateau, or was it?
I think it was about halfway through.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I were to call. There's just a lot of there's a lot of crying, blowing your nose and crying things out, right?
Yeah.
There was just a lot of kind of brotherhood stuff. You guys might have come in this. You really heal in groups. I feel like I don't know if I could have just done all the healing on my own. And I was telling the group this morning, or saying, or I think we were talking about it together, that you kind of, but you start that here, right? You really, you think you're like, oh, I'm gonna get out of here and I'll be 100%, right? Yeah. I'm not 100%. I don't know if I'll ever be 100%, but that's just where you begin stuff. And then the real work is kind of outside, right? Yeah. So
we did a podcast last season on group work.
Yeah.
That how special that is. Yeah. And in some ways, it's kind of a dying art, as it were. Sure. Dying.
Oh, really?
Because it's even though it's clinical, most of the time it's clinical. Right. There's some.
Yeah.
CISM has a, you know, a debrief group process I know that I've done for a long time, but leading, directing, guiding, and drawing out, there's a lot of artistry to that group, and I know you and your team do it really well. You'll speak to that?
Yeah, no, I think there is, you know, back to this idea of these kind of expectations that we developed about what healing is.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't typically have, you know, the vision of, you know what I need? A bunch of folks to watch me cry.
Yeah.
Men don't go there.
Nobody really wants that. Yeah.
So it's funny. There's, and this is a piece of what I think does some real serious damage when it comes to the stigma stuff, is that there is this, I am going to will myself. I'm going to take this emotion into some kind of a headlock, make it submit so I get my life back. Yeah. There's some real odd messages culturally about what it means to do that. But I super agree with you. No, there's something about that group process, whether it's that first day of someone sees me, all these images in my head of how judged I was going to be.
Yeah.
It just didn't happen.
Yeah.
I think I say this a lot in group, but learning how to be wrong and learning how to say, man, that image in my head was purely fiction. Yeah. Those are such great moments. And I think sometimes we forget to do that after we're done with a therapist's office, is pursue opportunities to still be wrong and to rewrite and to empower and to do some of those things. But I love that part of the group process, because we just get in our heads and it does take someone else to be brave and to speak up and do something that helps us be like, oh yeah.
And to point something out for you in your story, or for you to learn something from their stories, or you compare, not to compare to judge, but to compare like, I kind of remember that, or that's a fact, you know, to me, or,
right.
Yeah.
or right. hear other things that are, I mean, this sounds weird, but like worse than yours, right? Like it was kind of weird. You know, a big thing that I really had a hard time with is, man, come on, I got to be really weak. I mean, there's guys out there that have done, seen and been to and done so much worse, right? Like, you know, I think I talked about my dad and my partner and sure. you know, all these other things. Like, why am I the one, right? And then somebody said here, another guy in the cohort, Pat, you know, trauma's not a competition, right? You know, you don't have to have the toughest, worst story, right? right? And that was helpful. Those things right. are helpful, right? Like, yeah. so it's helpful to kind of know. It's hard to hear the other people and their stories. You're just like, oh yeah. my gosh, you know, it's really hard. But there's something useful in that too.
Yeah, that competition part yeah. is pretty wild because yeah. there is this who can stay the sickest the longest.
Yeah, yeah.
And the, yeah. and there is this perception of there's some sort of social reward.
Yeah, yeah.
For, right. for doing right. that, which seems strange yeah. because you hear their story and you're yeah. like, why'd you carry that for so long? Yeah. Like we yeah. all love you like yeah. crazy. Like yeah. you're totally worth it.
I'm handling it just fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't worry I'm about okay.
Me. Yeah.
yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's an odd part of our culture like that. But no, I love your point. And I do think that's an experience that a lot of folks don't really bump into. And I was mentioning this in group earlier this morning. Unless you be part of a 12-step community, mm-hmm. there's not a lot of folks breaking the ice, speaking up, getting
yeah.
involved.
Yeah.
And you don't get to have someone that, in a way, their little moment of courage kind of pulls you out of your own yeah. bullshit and gets you into, oh, wow, there's so many options.
Yeah,
I think it's important too that and I know Ben, you talk about this. You just talked about this at our training the other day. But there's an implied, if not an openly spoken, permission in groups like what we have at Chateau. I know yeah. we're not the only kid on the block that does this.
Yeah,
and you mentioned a 12-step program that does it, but there's a permission given, like it's okay for you to give me feedback, even though I may not like it or
yeah.
or. It's going to taste like shit.
Yeah.
But that permission, there's a lot of growth within that.
Yeah.
Of just saying, give me that feedback because I want it. Some accountability, some really less than palatable mm-hmm. Words put to, mm-hmm. this is going to suck a little bit, but it's important.
It's tough too, to sit there and tell your story, you know, to, yeah. To the whole group. I remember doing that. You tell your story, they kind of build it up to be a big thing. It is a big thing, right? Mm-hmm. But you sit there in front of, you know, it's kind of early on, I feel like, or at least it was for me or whatever, but you're sitting there in front of all these people you don't really know, and you're telling them why you're all messed up, what happened to you, you know, it takes a lot of courage.
Right.
And then to hear other people do that, and you're thinking, wow, we, you know, that's just, it's helpful. I mean, yeah. it's, I don't know how else you'd do it, but yeah.
So what I was kind of mentioning that even I've been watching you pretty close. Not
you've anything been other than me?
I remember my first time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yep.
I can almost place myself in the same position because even as we were interacting today, you yeah. were seeing words like timeline, mm-hmm. You know, which is what we're talking about.
Comes
now,
back to you, right?
Yeah, and how timer, you're yeah, like, yeah. You just have this,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you know, this memory hits you
yeah.
of the impact of that.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I'm just, I remember how hard that was and satisfying and
yeah.
educational and growing and, you know, all these things of, you know, and you used a very accurate word. It takes a lot of courage to just, yeah. here I am, folks.
You need that love back afterwards when everybody gets up and gives you a hug or right, says right. something yeah. or whatever. And yeah.
Yeah.
you're not alone, yeah, you know, sure. and you're not that screwed up, right? Because, right. you know, yeah.
Yeah, we're never as,
yeah.
as much as our head tells us we
yeah,
are.
Right, yeah.
It's funny because I was in a group today and some, you know, brave soul jumps up there
sure,
and
yeah.
takes a swing and yeah. tells a story. And we were talking about it a little bit afterwards. And it is, and again, this comes full circle a little bit of where we're at is... everyone wants this, what they refer to as post-traumatic growth.
Right. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Heard this. Yeah.
Everyone's yeah. signing up for that. Everyone
yeah.
wants that.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't even
take some.
Yeah. No one's going to take a leap unless you believe there's some actual change
yeah. Yeah.
around the corner.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the power of someone's story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's loads of little clinical tidbits and details that are out there, but almost all of it takes a backseat to just stories.
Yeah.
And it is a story about hope and growth and survival, right? Yep. I just need to get through it. I think there's lots of folks that are incredibly strong that just get through it, but they don't have the hope. They don't have the enlightenment.
Yeah.
They don't have the, the resilience, but just the education of now I know what not to do. And now I know what to look for with my other brothers and sisters in this process. So I love that that's, even though that may not have been your goal, 17 months ago.
Yeah.
I love that, part of what you get to do is do your part, and that is through the story.
Well, Brad, you asked me earlier today, like, hey, what do you do now? Or, what are you relying on now? And I was, going through, hey, I do this. But I think the other thing is just recognition, like, uh-oh, I'm going a little bit down that, mm-hmm. I'm starting to have whatever, and hey, I can stop this too, or I know how to handle this, right? Because now I've got a bunch of tools and I don't need to get to that place where I'm laying in bed and panic attack or whatever. Right. We were talking about signs of that growth, right? But mm-hmm. signs of just improvement. I'd drive along and I'd see this one girl, and I still see her waiting for a bus. she had purple hair or whatever, and I would look at her every day and think, oh, she's going to be another victim. Here's another victim, right? Mm-hmm. And I just see bad everywhere. Bad. Like just, and now I don't see that the same way. Right? Hopefully she's not another victim, obviously, but I just see like, she's just a girl, right? So you see these things and you kind of let them go. I think that's a concept my wife uses is, these are just thoughts and stuff. You just let them go on down, right? Just
passing through.
Yep, passing through.
Great point.
Yeah.
So if we look towards the end of your stay at Chateau, you've definitely seen some things that are growth things. What's the mentality of now going home? Leaving Chateau, because I want to transition us to, this is not the rest of your story. This is, there's a lot more to your article.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to your story pertinent to the listeners here. But I don't want to ignore this transition piece of what you've done at Chateau and how you start integrating back home.
Yeah. Well, this was, I think I'm really whatever your small group or your first responders group, because this is really big on my mind. Like, okay, well, what next? Now I've done work. I'm going to get out of here. What do I do next? And there was that kind of like, you want to prep, right? So I left Chateau and I left pretty darn good. I felt really good. And then I got back in, and I left in November, right? Yeah. So then it was the holidays and I started getting back, but I got back to work. I'd run out of leave, so I had no other option either. So I just got back to work and back, and I was kind of honest to most folks about where I'd been and stuff. Because I was like, why hide it? and the organization, had some problems with how they dealt with it. And that's in the article, how we can improve and stuff. But then I just started to feel, as the months went by, the demons are creeping back, right? Mm-hmm. Like it was just, I was back in this stuff again, right? It was coming back. I was just having a hard time dealing with stuff. And Sandy, my therapist, is like, Pat, you can't really heal if you keep getting injured. If the doc says quit playing rugby and you keep playing rugby, there's not much I can, you gotta. And after a while, I just started thinking, I don't know if I can do this anymore. They'd moved me to an admin job, so I was away from it. But then I was like, well, I didn't really join the bureau and, my store, Dior Bali, and stuff. I didn't do all that for an admin job. Like, that's not really that fulfilling. But also, I can't do the rest of this stuff anymore. I'm no good as a hostage negotiator because I'm, having the heebie-jeebies again or whatever. And so I eventually just quit and moved on to new things. And that was really hard. So, there were some good questions about how did that make you feel? Cause identity is wrapped up in it. And how do I quit this thing that, literally I'd give at one point I'd give my left foot to be an FBI agent and stuff like that, you know, and like, why did I just do that? So that was kind of the rest of the story. Like I had to get out of it, you know.
I hate to get, I hate to keep referencing the group this morning, but we did talk, you know, at length. We had a little bit more space and time devoted to this particular point. So for our listeners, we, you know, I want to kind of latch onto that a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, this disengagement, even though you say, I quit, I think it was more intentional.
Well, I mean, a quit kind of was like, I'm throwing in the towel, but like,
But there's a lot. There was a lot of thoughts behind the how and the why and the progress forward and probably some conversations with, you know, the I told you so lady that you were married to. And, you know, the can you put some words to that?
Absolutely. You know, you know, nobody said, hey, I think you need to quit. Right. Everybody was happy that I was back and better. Right. That was kind of my own decision to that I needed to start something new, start something different and close that chapter. So the quit's kind of like, I quit. But I think I came to a realization that this was literally killing me and it almost killed me. I almost got to a place, not it, like, you know, they had a title of the article at one point, like the FBI almost killed me or something like that. I'm like, no. And then when the FBI that almost killed me, it was, you know, so I didn't want it to be something stupid like that, but I couldn't get bothered by this stuff anymore, and I needed to do it for myself and for my family, because that was way more important. That's where I drug myself to Chateau, because somebody told me, hey, look, dude, you can just keep on doing how you're doing and self-medicating and, you know, whatever, and then yet at some point you might not be here, or you can spend 30 days and or longer or shorter, whatever, get yourself better and then be a good dad again, right? You know, that kind of thing. So
was I that harsh on you?
I don't think that was you.
It does sound familiar.
It was somebody, it was some former cop, because it was somebody like that. And I was like, you know, I guess that's kind of right. And he said, I've seen this line of work, this thing, blow up a lot of people, a lot of marriages, a lot of families, and a lot of stuff. And
well, I know the FBI would love to think that it's unique and special in a lot of ways, which in a lot of ways they are. But in this way, they are not. This is a microcosm conversation of a lot of agencies saying, we're not sure how to handle this. I know they would not say that literally, but I mean, this is culture wide. This is not unique to FBI.
Well, I think there's lots of pieces, whether it's within the culture or outside of the culture, there is this idea that the only way to exit is after you're chewed up and spit out and you've given it all. And I think it's tough, and you're not alone at all, where folks are just, they have a hard time understanding that their evolution's gonna have several chapters to it. And I think if folks still are stuck in some of the stigma, which is, no, they get 100% of me, and then I'm gonna be grumpy and drunk for the last few years before I die. That's a pretty sad story. But no, I love the idea of, I need to evolve. And we talk a lot about personal balance around here. And it's all right for that balance to shift from, hey, my identity and my responsibility, even my unhappiness was configured in this particular way, and now it's time for it to evolve, and it's going to include just more of husband, father, or just this other area I haven't explored yet. And there's not a lot of permission given in our culture to, it's time for you to evolve. It's time for your marriage to evolve. It's time for your fatherhood to evolve. Like, those are awesome things. And yes, it's new territory, but I love the idea of, I'm moving on because it's the healthiest thing for me. It may not always be about spite and resentment and all of that kind of stuff. It's just, I'm going to grow into something, and it doesn't have to be the old
stuff. Well, I would have had 6 more years till I regularly retired, a little under that, And I started seeing the trajectory and thinking, I don't care if it's worth the $2 million retirement or whatever. It doesn't matter, you know, if I'm not around to enjoy it or if I'm the whatever. So that, you know, and then in June, I handed in my resignation, and a lot of people who didn't really know the whole story were kind of like, what? You know, because agents don't really leave normally before 20 years, right? Until they're totally spit out, chewed up, spit out. And that was hard, but it was also pretty awesome to walk out that door too, right? And there's a lot of hard things about not being FBI agent cool anymore, right? Mm-hmm. But I know we were talking about earlier, like, that's not what made you cool, right? Like, it's who you are, right? And it's once I was able to kind of detach from that, I think that helped a lot. It's tough too, because I think the first responder community, when the days are good, it's awesome. There's some times, and I can imagine it being a firefighter or a nurse, or, you know, I can tell you my experiences. Some days you're like, man, this is like a movie. This is awesome. Like, who's having this experience right now? So it's hard to give that up. But also the lows and the things that takes away from you are tough too, right? And I just didn't want that to be like that for me anymore.
Well, it's an easy, I don't know if it's easy, but there's some clarity when we ask our family, those whose opinions we value the most. They're like, which part of me do you want to see more of, this cool title, or you just want to see me more?
Yeah.
They're always quick to say, we just want you.
Yeah. We just want you around and with it now, you know, like,
right.
Enjoyable. Right.
Sure.
I think one of the cooler things that I heard this morning was, about, and you just said it almost without even realizing it, but now recognizing things that are coming at you that have put you in a bad space before, and now using tools against that and saying, no, I'm gonna work and make sure that I stay healthy, and not just combat them with the old me, compartmentalize. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's just a negativity. I'll deal with that later, or maybe never.
Yeah.
And to hear you talking this morning, can you speak to that a little bit as to what that looks like for you on like a daily basis now?
Yeah. You know, for what it looks like, I mean, I think it's going to be different for everybody. And kind of what you implement when, how you grow, right? How you get better. I stayed in therapy for probably another 8-9 months afterwards, every week. And kept working through some stuff. And then at one point it was kind of like, well, you know, I think we're good. Like, you know, you're ready to leave the nest, right? You know, and then and I checked back in with her a couple months later, cause I needed to do some stuff. And then, you know, I can check back in with her. So there was that component, but there was also like taking care of yourself. Right.
Yeah.
It's good to go to the gym. I probably haven't been there in a while, but you know, that kind of stuff. I pray more. I know you meditate, but it's something similar, right? I did some cold dips, ice baths or whatever with my buddy. That's one thing I end up really liking here. I didn't think I was going to, because I was like, that's kind of my thing. It might kill me because I get cold and, you know, I'm doing this thing. And I actually really like that. So it's implementing those things. But then just recognizing, I think, when you're getting triggered by things, or when you're kind of slipping back in the old ways, and putting a stop to that too. I did this morning, you know, when I woke up, I was kind of getting nervous about being on your podcast, man, you know, and thinking, and then I was thinking, wait a minute, I don't need to do that. You know, I know how to do that. Right? Get up, take a shower and say my prayers and get outside and, you know, it's fine, you know? And anyway, always growing, right? Always working at it. Always.
Well, I think if we're kind of wrapping up here and looking at the totality of this entire story, I would probably want to give you the opportunity to, for any first responders, your FBI peers, those cops out there, firefighters, veterans listening, just some wisdom from some Pat wisdom of, if you find yourself here, what are some things that you would say to, or a message that you would give of hope, of you know, just what message would you give them if people are listening to this? Because we have a lot of people listen to this that either are in dark places or know people. I know a lot of our listeners are they are connected with people and hopes that, you know, somehow this is the magic podcast for them. And maybe it is. You know, maybe it is. If you were going to give them this message of just,
well, when I was in a tough place, I'd call my mom and my sister and my friends and stuff. People would send me stuff all the time. Hey, listen to this and that. Some things I would, some things, you know, Hopefully it does.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, if it hits one person the right way, it's worth it, right?
You bet.
But it's clear for me what that message would be, because I was in a dark place for a while, too long. I know you were too.
Yep.
Too long. And the message is, it's not always going to be like this.
Yeah.
And it will get better. It can get better. And it will get better, right?
Yeah.
And don't, I mean, I think the worst thing was for me in that dark place when I was like, hey, the world will be better without me around, which is a ridiculous thing to say. That was a rational thought at that point, because you're in such a dark place and you're thinking, it won't get better.
Yeah.
But it does, and I am here to say it does. I was walking around the, you know, the grounds, thinking like, look at me now, 17 months later, this is amazing, you know, and it does, you know. So hang in there. That's kind of the thing. Hang in there, because it will get better.
Hang in, help's coming.
Yep, help's coming. Yeah, that's what you told me. Yeah. Yeah. Hang in there, help's coming.
Fix it.
Right, we're fixing to get you in here, right? Some reason I believed you, yeah. Yeah. That's
great. Well, Pat, thanks so much for coming on. Ben, any final thoughts on that?
Just thanks for making the time.
Yeah.
No, it's a great message. Thanks for, you easily could have blown off the whole thing as like, I'll let someone else write some article. I'll let someone else tell their story.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah.
Thanks for following that little prompting that you had to do something a little bit outside your comfort zone, because it's I'm excited that you already get to see some of the results of that, and, and likely will for a while.
Yeah.
So keep it
thanks
up.
For what you guys do. Saving lives.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I echo Ben. I think there certainly needs to be a on behalf of not just Chateau or No One Fights Alone listeners, but the community and as a whole, they need more stories out here like that, written with boldness and courage, from the spirit of this is what happened to me and this is what can be for you.
Yeah.
You know, if you're willing to be courageous enough to take that step. And so, you know, on behalf of all that, thanks for writing the article. And well said, Ben. And for the No One Fights Alone podcast listeners, well, I always usually give people the opportunity. Do you want to be found? If you want to throw your name out there.
Sure.
If somebody wants to connect with you.
Absolutely. Maybe and it's funny. People are like, hey, can I share your article? I'm like, heck yeah. You know, sending that to the whole world, right? No, please don't hesitate at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I can ever help anybody, right, you know, I absolutely would, because a lot of people helped me to get me here and get me to where I am now. So, yeah.
We'll be sure and put a link to the article on the podcast release when we release it. So the link will be attached. But
cool. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Pat.
See ya.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.